Okay, it's Tacky Chan time because it's Friday and we talked to Tacky twice this week. This is like a twofer, Tacky.
Oh, absolutely. Or we could do deja vu. We just play Mondays and see if people figure out there's a difference.
Oh no, lots has changed. Your hair is a little longer. I think you have a different shirt on. So I'm wearing a tie, so things are different.
Shake it up a bit.
And since last we talked, there's been a presidential debate. Did you watch it?
I did watch it. It's amazing how threatening to turn off the mic has created a new level of civility in a debate.
Yes. Any surprises in your mind?
Not so many big surprises. I think the polling, and even in battleground states, the undecideds are shrinking really, really quickly in the polling. I know people that go, the polls were wrong 4 years ago. Yeah, but the polling folks readjusted their formulas from 4 years ago. And people think polling is a fixed science, just call people and ask questions. It's a little more involved than that. Every time a new election cycle goes, or a new marketing program, or whatever, I mean, polling isn't just for politics. I mean, it's also about marketing and product placement and things like that. They adjust the formula again to reflect the changing demographics. So, do I say it's 100% right? Obviously, you can never say that, but I think their accuracy is much better. And last night continues to be a reflection of a dichotomy of two presidents, candidates. President Trump continues to maintain a very specific image that some people appeal to and some people don't. And Biden hasn't really changed pretty much his entire life, it feels like, in terms of demeanor. It was very two different personalities on the stage. And I think both have been very consistent in the messaging as much as possible. Biden continues to maintain the message of this is about you, not us, talking directly to the camera. Trying to continue to poke holes in the Trump administration, which is what the challenger does. And that's the point of challenging incumbents. And laying out, very much the Democratic platform. He's not hiding from the platform. The president continues to tout his record and his vision of the current set of circumstances. But I agree that the president doesn't have a future vision. I mean, make America great again implies that you made it bad because you're the one running the show. Blaming the other party to make it great again is really disingenuous. I think it's continue the messaging should mean let's continue moving forward because you want to continue your administration. So, it's interesting watching how messaging that really hasn't changed from 4 years ago for a person who's essentially not an incumbent and part of the institution. And CNN pointed out some things last night. And I don't. It was kind of like, eh, through most of the pundits because I'm kind of cynical these days. But one thing they didn't point out is a lot of insider baseball information from the president in particular, especially towards the second half attacking Biden. People who watch these things that aren't junkies really had no idea what he was talking about corruption issues of Biden that has not materialized in any substantive news media, conversations about his character that has not materialized really in any news media. So it's hard to follow attacks on personal character or finances if no one's heard about it at all prior and manufacturing news, new attacks on the fly. So I thought that was pretty interesting observation. But I do think, majority, super majority people have already made up their minds which way they're going.
That really is the biggest difference from 4 years ago, is the number of people who have already voted.
Yes, I mean, 50 million plus people have already voted by absentee early voting or vote by mail, depending on what state you're in. Massachusetts, I think, is closing in on 30%. It's probably going to be almost 50% before Election Day in a couple of weeks. It's only a couple of weeks, only 10 days nationwide,
Yeah,
actually.
not even, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's actually part of the problem with this late debate is that, would this change your mind if you're already through your ballot? It is clear that neither candidate is looking to change anyone's mind. They're here to drive out the base, GOTV via debate, and to appeal to what little other undecided voters there are. I think the average percentage poll of undecided voters is below 6%. And conventional wisdom always tells me that it's impossible for either candidate to get the entire undecided vote. Very likely, very hard to do so. So if your margin of the polling margin is high enough between the person and the undecideds are relevant. For example, Biden's up 13 in New Hampshire earlier this week. Undecided, there's no undecideds left. It's not going to matter. But if you're in a tight race like you are in Texas, oddly enough, is within 4 points. I mean, maybe there'll be much more of a difference. So this is not Hillary Clinton campaign. This is a very different focus campaign from the Biden camp to target places they should have invested heavily 4 years ago, which they did not invest heavily. Have a candidate stay on message, the best they can. And I think, create a real dichotomy of appeal. And also, I didn't agree with this tactic, but to actually address Donald Trump directly, not just ignore him. And Biden early on was presenting the president with questions, which put him on his defense, which, the president wanted to have to answer, on the fly. So the first, 30 plus minutes was very substantive, and the second half was, just attacking him.
Yeah.
But because of the format, he couldn't speak over anyone, he couldn't interrupt, he couldn't take time away, which made it much more apparent and much more clear what statements the president was making.
Yeah, of course, the other big, huge difference this year is we're in the midst of a global pandemic. I mean, how much do you think that is going to affect the way the election is turning out?
Well, people vote in the current set of circumstances. People will vote when they're very impassioned, inspired, or very angry. And we do know that there are voters that vote every 4 years. This is not lost on you. And I think the current pandemic, plus the economic situation, plus, civil unrest involving racial justice has accumulated into an enormous voter turnout. And, we all know that not every person that is unhappy with the current situation can get out and protest. And I think it's wise for people not to get out and protest in the middle of a pandemic. But you have the ability to voice your opinion through the ballot box. And I'm very encouraged to see a lot of advertising, a lot of celebrities, reminding folks to not just stay safe and avoid unnecessary contact people and don't go anywhere if you're not feeling well, but also to take advantage of opportunities we provide through state governments. The state governments run elections, not the federal government, to get your voice heard.
Let's talk a little bit about the state government. The governor, as you know, this week unveiled his own kind of economic stimulus plan for Massachusetts, said he's tired of waiting for the feds to do something. What do you think about it?
Well, I'm tired of waiting for the feds too, to be perfectly honest with you. Like I talked about last time, we are going to move forward in state budget. We're still analyzing the governor's numbers in the state budget, but we do not expect any more than paying the minimum we need to get this basic state government functions going. That includes things like earmarks or special projects that the people enjoy coming from us to municipalities and nonprofits and development things with the cities. So, prepare for a fairly bare bone situation. The governor put forth a proposal, which frankly, I'm still trying to figure out how he's paying for the whole thing. But it appears to be a combination of utilizing existing resources that weren't expended yet because the pandemic interrupted some of our programs in workforce development, economic development, and investments, because things were closed. You can't put money into a business if they can't produce, and you can't operate workforce training if it isn't training anybody, right? So I think they're repurposing some of the money that stays within the line item purposes to put into the economy, like talk about the Mass Tech Collaborative, for example, where they're using their monies there to redirect it into the new world of COVID in science and tech. So there's been some money shifting around, but it isn't outside the purpose of the agency, it's still within it. Some stuff he has to come back to us to get approval for, and some stuff looks like he's using some extra pandemic money. We didn't just drop like a whole billion dollars in one sweep. I mean, we authorized the government to spend it over a period of time. And I do think that the governor is using a little bit of that pandemic money that's left to close those up. So I've not figured out where all $700 million is coming from. It's very clear it's a combination of administrative land. You can't move between landers. Creative thinking of the purpose of the state agency's money. How's that sound?
Okay. Redefining things based on need, sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, let's stretch a few definitions, right? Some pandemic money and a good portion of that would be part of the state budget. So don't expect the entire $700 million to be spent in the near term. I think it'll be piecemeal all over the course of the next several months. But, you know, is it going to help us? Definitely no. I mean, this continues to be a immediate address measure while waiting to see where COVID goes, as well as where the federal funding is, depending on how November 3rd comes out.
Yeah. Speaking of COVID, we saw just recently some rollbacks when it comes to indoor ice hockey. Do you think we're going to start to see more kind of targeted rollbacks as the numbers go up?
Yeah, I regret to say that is going to be the case. You know, the cases are approaching 1,000 for the first time since the early parts. So it was like 988 or something yesterday was the number. Thankfully, deaths are staying under 20 per day. I can't believe we're saying things like this, to be frank with you. I was saying it's good to keep it under 20 a day. It's just awful saying things like this.
Well, I remember when we first started talking, you know, way back in March, we were hoping 2,500 deaths total. So here we are, you know, over 9,500.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you're right. That's my best case scenario when I was talking about it. And now we're going to approach 10,000, which is 4 times worse than my best case scenario. It's very depressing to talk about this way. We're going to have to do some rollbacks. I mean, you know, as we all know, younger people getting infection rates is still less likely to die, but they are transmitters. What's disturbing is we watched news last night and people still visiting Salem from Cincinnati and Virginia from out of state, which have some rising COVID counts. So we have out of staters still coming in because we're quote unquote safe to go to. And of course, we know what the impact on college campuses have had on students' return already. So, you know, there is increased transmission because we just don't know who we can come in contact with in our travels. And we all know we can't be hermited in nonstop. We actually have to get, you know, stuff done that requires leaving the house. But it is very troubling that we've spent so much effort and time and first-time testers, not repeat testers, first-time testers is closing in at 4.5 to 5% daily average. When the governor changed those numbers around after that, you know, Channel 5's investigative report regarding how these numbers work, because I always question myself, questions like, does this include the retesting people?
Yeah.
Just in first time testing, you know, daily average is 4.5%. That's bad. That's not good.
You know, that gives you a much clearer picture of how it's spreading in the community, I would think.
Yeah, you've seen in the governor's color-coded chart, the continued expansion of red and green, red and yellow. And you know, let's admit it, it's kind of arbitrary, right? If you're, you know, 0.1 versus, you know, 0.2, I mean, they can shift you from one color to the next. So, but the idea is to give us a general sense of where we're heading and where things are clustering. And unfortunately, it isn't that simple. You can't say that you have one red and everything around it's green. And suddenly it means like, oh, you know, it's just that one bad spot in the middle. Just because you're high infection community doesn't necessarily mean spread to it. You could have been transported in from Boston, for example. You're in Boston working and you come back with it. This is a very amorphous situation.
Yeah, and it can be skewed by things like if you have a correctional facility in your community or a large number of nursing homes or assisted living facilities, you know, so that just the blanket color doesn't tell the whole story.
No, it does not. It's there more of as a cautionary signal to the public to this isn't over. I think it's a better way to put it. Because, you know, you look at it, you're actually correct, because you don't know what a super spreader is. It's a special circumstance regarding a specific locale having a high infection rate. It doesn't like spread through the city or town. But I think it is an effective tool to remind folks that this is here. This is still continuing to be very serious. And there is nowhere that isn't impacted by happens.
Yeah, that's right. It's a pandemic. That's the definition of the term, right? Is it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What's happening in your district, Jackie, here in Quincy?
Well, a lot of stuff is mostly municipal projects. I mean, mm-hmm. anyone that lives in Bell's Neck and Admiralshire and Germantown are fully aware of the seawall construction going on along C Street and, across Post Island Road and other city-owned seawalls, a combination of local, federal, and state dollars have gone into that. I've been very thankful we've not had any major coastal storms. Mm-hmm. Nothing's worth trying to do seawall replacement during any time period because you just don't know what the weather's going to be. So it appears a lot of these kind of first phase stuff has gone up. I'm aware the city is doing a lot of utility work up and down C Street. So that's obviously caused some traffic issues coming in out of the area. But at the same time, it's a good time to get it done during the pandemic because there was no traffic then. And the intersection on Quincy Shore Drive and C Street was completed early this year, and it looks quite wonderful, moving the traffic flow. So a lot of this stuff, the city projects, that's what I'm talking about. Dave McCarthy can give you more details. But, some state dollars that the way the delegation was able to get in the past is coming to fruition. I worked pretty hard to get some of these dollars over the years to the district, but just because I get the money, it takes time for it to happen. Right. And very, very happy to see that happen. So, overall, a lot of the calls I'm getting are still considered unemployment cases. I fully expect that landlord cases and tenant cases are going to be coming up in the near future because of the end of the moratorium, and we'll see how some of the governor's economic proposals on trying to help people with housing, such as putting more more judges on standby and ready to go on tenant cases, as well as some housing assistance fundings. But at the same time, a discussion about what we're going to do with this new construction for affordable housing. That still takes time to get done. Right now, people need housing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm like, it's great you're talking about this, but that's going to take time to happen. We got a problem right now. And where were you 2 years ago? Not to be critical, I am being critical, but we knew this was a problem. It takes a pandemic to tell you that we need more affordable housing. We got to make the developers do it by creating certain incentives. We're already there. I proposed an idea to the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development that we have all this T property, community rail property. It's ideal for micro apartments. And you could build 800 square feet units for new people, new college kids, new graduates, first time job folks, to get the young people to start, get them out of parents' homes near public transportation. And since it's government property, you don't have to worry about property taxes. Get a developer to put it together, and then a hire management company over a long-term time to manage it with a state audit.
Like in parking lots, things like that, you mean?
Well, they're already doing it in North Quincy parking lot.
True.
You could require it as part of a garage construction.
I see.
With a housing component. So you could do some kind of affordable or short-term, like 5 years mm-hmm. program where people get their feet on the ground and go back out there and rotate the apartments around. Not designed to be a permanent housing solution, a temporary housing solution for first time, people that graduate school and get their first jobs.
Okay.
So you can set up income guidelines and things like that. And same thing, commuter stations. You have space, here and there over the place. But now the preference is to give it to private developers to make as much money as possible on the project. And that's been the mentality, frankly, of the governor's administration. Doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. As I talk to some of my other friends in private sector advocate for housing, I'm not talking about not-for-profits. I mean, these are developers and people making money on property. I'm like, you're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. You just keep making yourself look great by advocating to me to spend taxpayer money. But you yourselves are not proposing anything that, making the money to try to solve this problem. So no one likes it when I say things like that to them. It's always like, well, it's a government problem. It's taxpayers should pay for it. They're just like, yeah, but you're making oodles of money. So you're not really part of the solution.
Hmm.
Like I said, no one likes to hear me say things to them.
But I've never stopped you before, right?
No, it gets me in trouble. I suspect this podcast is going to get me in trouble. I can see the angry emails coming.
That's my job, Jackie. We can't talk about the census anymore because it's all over.
Yes, it is. After literally months of talking about the census, it is all over. Right now, the president has a case going through the courts. It's probably going to make Supreme Court about whether or not we're going to allow undocumented or immigrants to be considered part of the census count as part of redistricting, actually, which is going to be kind of an interesting case. If you look at the census history, we've actually had some, you go to the website, they actually have like a census history. There's some interesting things there. For example, everyone, if you know your history, unfortunately, slaves were considered three-fifths human beings because of the whole balancing act of the founding of the country regarding northern states and southern states and trying to create a union, imperfect union as it was, as a union. And then you look at Native Americans, Indians, they were not considered accounted for the census because they were quote-unquote non-taxed. Well, the reason they caught on tax is because they were sovereign nations.
Right.
So, I mean, people need to be careful about these terms. Just because, if you say non-tax, does not mean you don't get counted. I mean, there are a lot of senior citizens not paying taxes. They're on Social Security right now. Should not be counted in the census. So don't get caught up on these words. Native Americans, American Indians, depending on what term you read in the U.S. Census, you got to look at the website. Everyone, the federal government uses all kinds of different terms for Native Americans. Those groups were non-taxed because they were sovereign nations. And now in the 21st century, these sovereign nations are at the will of the Congress. They make these sovereign nations.
Right.
The U.S. Congress can choose to make them completely non-taxable, pursuant to ancient treaties at this point in the U.S. Constitution. Yep.
They can still pay tax to their sovereignty, though.
That's correct. The individual sovereignties can make taxes, just like the state can do taxes.
Right.
Same principle, but they treat it as a independent quasi, they're an independent entity within states, but only subject to federal government pursuant to the treaties, or by federal law if it's a federally created status. So that's why you see in there this funny term non-tax. It's referencing their sovereign statehood, not their, tax-paying people.
Right.
So, I mean, there's some terminology that people want to start twisting around saying, well, you're non-tax, you can't be part of the census. So what does that mean? Well, there's enormous ramification if we discount people who are here on non-legal status, or even here on legal status, aren't even citizens, because it greatly skews the congressional districts. We've been going on a single-count method for nearly 100 years, get within one person, each congressional district. Once you start taking those folks out of the district, it's a huge impact in certain states. So in states like Texas, states like California, states like Florida, which have large immigrant populations, are going to have a very skewed effect as a result of taking those folks out of the census count for redistricting purposes. So, we'll see how how the courts respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Constitution said, you only have to count every single resident, but how you use that information for counting other residents, I think is up for grabs for interpretation.
Yeah. All right. Got to wrap it up today, unfortunately, but next time, Jackie, I want to see you in your best Halloween costume. It's going to be the day before Halloween.
I haven't had a Halloween costume since I was 7.
Well, it's about time then. And it has to involve a face mask.
Let me see. I don't know what I have in my closet. We'll take a look around.
In the meantime, how do folks get in touch with you?
Well, continue to call me at the office at 617-722-2014 or 617-722-2014. We're not in the office still because there's no place to move around in the office. But we've been checking our voicemails and just hit any staff person. We'll get back to you. You can still email at tacky.chan, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. Again, it's still getting flooded with emails, so it takes a while to sift through it. Do check my social media, State Representative Tacky Chan. We answer a lot of your questions there, as well as tackychan.org. Some information will be there as well to help you out before you actually have to call me. So that might save you some time.
All right. Sounds good. Good to see you, Tacky. Thanks so much.
Good to see you, Joe. I'll see you in a week.
All right. Bye-bye.